it actually puts our minority communities, our student communities, our rural communities at risk of people not having access to vote.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus, and on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, we'll listen to my extended interview with Barbara Bartoletti, the retired former legislative director for the League of Women Voters of New York State. She's being honored for her four-decade career next week. First, she came by the WAMC studios. And normally in March in Albany, when Barbara Bartoletti is here, it's to talk about something to do with the state budget or what's going on at the Capitol. She's retired now and she's being honored this month. Barbara Bartoletti, welcome back to WAMC.
Thank you so much for having me back.
What have you been up to so far in your retirement?
Well, in the winter, I've done a lot of skiing with grandchildren. I have 8 grandsons, all of whom I have taught how to ski. So I've done a lot of that whenever the conditions warrant. Did a lot of that this year with them. And in the summer, I have a very large yard with 4 or 5 decks, I guess, on which I have 35 planters and a big lawn to mow and keep track of. So that's taken up a lot of my time in the summer. And then, of course, I'm still involved with the league more on a local basis now with my local league, Rensselaer County League. And actually, we've been doing the complete count census recruitment at the Troy Farmers Market on Saturdays to get people to volunteer, which I am going to do also, to do the complete count. And you probably already know that April 1st is Census Day.
Sure.
People will be getting those census. They'll be getting notices. They can do it online, or if they don't do it online, probably like me, they will get a paper copy, but we've been encouraging people to volunteer to go out and help people who may need different communities, who may need help in filling out the census. So that's been fun, too.
Over the years that you were involved with issues like the census, like getting people registered to vote, like getting people turned out to vote, and now we're in another election year, have we improved on those fronts? Are things better than they were?
Oh, I wish I could say things had improved, but I think today, the day after Super Tuesday, now we did not vote in New York. We will vote in New York on April 24th or 28th, I think.
I'm not sure. 28th.
But we saw 6.5-hour lines in both Texas and California. And unfortunately, a lot of them were in areas we know have had problems before. Minority communities, student communities, where there is never enough resources, or whether it's perhaps intentional, but we know that there are not enough resources being put into getting people access to the polling places. Also, of course, we have to worry this year about cybersecurity, and I would not be convinced, and I think it's cautionary to people who are looking forward to the here in New York, we're really pretty good, well off in New York, because we do have paper trails, which some of these states didn't have, and we need to have all states have a paper trail by November. We need more resources, and I don't think that's being done in the federal Congress as much as it needs to be. I think there's probably some politics involved in that, but it actually puts our minority communities, our student communities, our rural communities at risk of people not having access to vote.
I know that the League is a nonpartisan organization, but as you just alluded to, it seems that the federal government, particularly in the Trump era, has not made voting rights a priority. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say. And yes, we are a nonpartisan organization. What we want, what we strive for, is that every single eligible American, every person eligible to vote, should be able to exercise that right to vote without the barriers that we see being put up all over the country. And so whether it's in minority communities, which perhaps might vote Democratic, or in rural communities, which might vote Republican, every single American eligible to vote should be given that right, and it should not be hard. And when you have to start serving people pizza and water because they've stood in line for 6 hours, that's really abysmal in this country. I mean, they don't do that. I mean, that's more like what happens in Kazakhstan and in Iran and Russia, all the course, they already know what the outcome is going to be. But here, we should be doing better than this.
How do you get young people to turn out?
Oh, that's been a chronic problem in this country. Young people, I think, and I now have, my oldest grandson is now eligible to vote and is registered to vote. A lot of the problem comes, take him for instance, his family lives in New Jersey. My daughter and son-in-law live in New Jersey with their three other boys, not eligible to vote. And he is in Maryland, and he is in Maryland, a new eligible to vote, but will he get, and that I keep telling my daughter, they have to get him the absentee ballot, send it to him, and then you kind of, and his grandmother's going to do a lot of that, hound him to fill out his absentee ballot. Because I, to be honest with you, I don't think he knows whether or not in Maryland, and I don't at the moment, know whether or not he could register and vote there as a college student. Here in New York, we have places where that's clearly done. But the best option for students is to get that absentee ballot, and that falls on their parents to a great degree, to get them that absentee ballot and then to make sure they fill it out. Other than that, students seem to be more involved in their everyday lives. Now, that said, with social media, they certainly are more aware. And so what we have to do is just, again, make it easy for them to vote. And it's usually not easy for college students or even young people who are out working. They may be working long hours, which brings me to another issue, which I think here in New York we have just recently done. We need a little tweaking of it, but early voting. Early voting should occur everywhere in this country now. We know it works. We know it gives people flexibility to get out and actually, because of their work schedule, allows them much more accessible and easier to do. And so we should be doing that everywhere. However, here in New York, we also know that the only early voting experience we've had, take Rensselaer County, the Board of Elections, in its ultimate wisdom, I think that's going to change, but they put the voting kiosks in two places that are not accessible either by bus, only accessible by car. And not,
and if
in
you
most,
lived in Troy, you couldn't go early
if you
vote.
Lived in Troy and you didn't have a car, you could not get to either one of them.
And we should say that's the population center of
Rensselaer
County.
And it is the population center. So I think, I want to say Senator Breslin, perhaps, in the state Senate, has legislation in that would say you must have an early voting site in anywhere where there's over 50,000 votes. And don't quote, I mean, I'd have to ask Jennifer Wilson, who is currently doing our lobbying, if that was exactly right. But I believe I have heard that that is pending in the state legislature. So that would certainly help because, again, we want people to have an easy time voting. If they had an easier time voting, we may get more than 51% of people in a presidential year. It goes down dramatically in areas, in elections that are for local. I mean, you know, if we get, I used to hear people down in the different boroughs that tell me they could win an election with 15,000 votes. They could get their friends and family to come out and vote, and they'd end up in the state legislature. That's abysmal. I mean, everybody, we ought to have, in a presidential year, we ought to have 82 to 85% of people voting, and we never do. We need to make it easier and more accessible.
Is it a bad idea to have three election days like we're going to have in New York this year? We've got the April presidential primary. We've got the June local and state and congressional primaries, and then we've got the big kahuna election day in November.
Well, that does put strain on the boards of elections. There's no doubt about that. And so people don't, it's like in your own budget, you don't worry about buying stuff to make your sidewalks less slippery until a storm comes and all of a sudden your steps are slippery. We don't think about elections until they start to roll around. We don't have enough money. The State Board of Elections never seems to have enough money in the state budget. That, of course, goes to a couple of factors. One, are they asking for enough money? And two, are the elected leaders, do they just want their people to get out and vote, or do they want everybody to get out and vote? Usually it's they want their people to get out and vote. So it doesn't seem to be high enough on anybody's priority list. And that's really chronic. I mean, that's been going on for decades. However, I think that I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I thought we had consolidated our primaries now. I thought the legislative primary and the presidential primary, well, we have a presidential primary in April, but isn't there now a single June primary instead of the September?
Congressional and state offices and local offices will all be in June.
So we have consolidated to some degree. That should indeed help the localities in not spending exorbitant amounts of money to bring in their staff, their volunteers, and the machines in for so many primary days. But the Board of Elections, I would tell you, the Board of Elections has never been given enough money to actually do the job well, and they should.
A couple more things. 2020 is a big year, a big anniversary. The League of Women Voters, we take for granted. Women could not always vote in this country. So you're being honored in conjunction with that anniversary. Tell us about that.
Yes. The League was very instrumental in the suffragist movement. It was actually like a lot of things today. There were kind of two wings of the suffragist movement. There was the more conservative wing and the more liberal wing, as we're seeing in our politics today. And finally, when we had fought, I mean, this was a 50-year battle for women to get the right to vote. And finally, when we did get it, the suffragettes who felt that we should go in a certain direction formed the League of Women Voters. And that was the direction where it was always felt during the fight for the right to vote that why did women need the right to vote? Their husbands were just going to tell them how to vote and, you know, it'd be two votes for every man. Well, the League decided that was not going to happen, that we were going to educate women voters so that they could exercise, be informed, and exercise their right. And that's been the League's mantra for the whole 100 years, obviously not just for women anymore. That happened decades and decades ago. But it's informing everyone about not only the right to vote, but what are the issues. And so as the League evolved, now we have men in the League. In fact, some of our most important positions now in the local leagues are men who are presidents, who are treasurers, etc. But what we have also been able to do is make sure that people have good information on the issues that are in an election. So we do all kinds of pamphlets on your first vote, student votes. We print things in all different languages, depending on where the League is, Spanish and Chinese, etc. And for many years, the League held the presidential debates. And I will tell you, after watching some of the debates the Democrats had, they should go back to the League. They were rather obnoxious. I mean, I don't know whether you could blame it on the celebrity moderators that wanted to have and liked the drama of television of people screaming at one another and talking over people, but it didn't inform the voters very well. If you do,
you don't think knowing what someone's motto is helpful to make a choice?
No, but I do think if you have calm, rational, nonpartisan people up there, as the League does in our debates. We do debates for school boards, for local elections, for congressional elections, state legislative elections, and we have a very strict format for exactly how that's done. And I think the League did it until 1988, and then the media wanted to take it over. And, you know, I love the media. However, this may not have been their finest moments this year. So
it's hard to do. It's hard to do well.
It is hard to do. It is hard to do well. And we have people, we have training sessions for people that are going to be moderators. And they get very experienced at doing this. And the audience seems to be aware because right from the beginning, our moderators kind of lay down the law. This will not be tolerated. You must be considerate of people. And we had one I remember going to where the one candidate had a group of motorcyclists, and every time his opponent started to speak, in this case it was her opponent, the motorcycles would rev their motors. And the moderator was very calm, and she just said, well, we're just going to sit here and wait until the people outside with their motors revving get tired of doing that. And, you know, that's kind of what League moderators are trained to do. You get into a situation and then you know how to take care of that situation so that both candidates or five candidates or whatever you have. School boards, you usually have more than, sometimes you have eight or nine of them, but so that everybody gets a way to put forward their argument so that the voters are extremely informed. And what we have seen in the last 4 or 5 years is that they're standing room only in a lot of these debates now. There is a hunger for people to really have a sense of, I want to know who I'm going to vote for. And I can only know if I hear it from that, you know, never mind the ads that are all over social media. I want to hear it from the voice of the person running for that office. Now, you can't do that for presidential candidates, but they certainly could have been better done than they were this year.
And I have to say, from WAMC's perspective, it's been a huge help to us because we like to cover those local races. And a lot of times, that might be the only night that the two people are going to come together before
That's
Election
right.
Day.
That's absolutely right. And we try with, especially in this area, we have three very active leagues in this area. So we try and even overlap with one another and make sure that every candidate's forum gets covered within that large area. So whether it's up in Washington County or down in the Hudson Valley or as far west as out in Binghamton, we can probably accommodate are like the congressional candidates who represent like 11 districts sometimes, and they wide. We have enough leagues in the state that we can get we have the ability to make sure that the voters in those areas get to hear from the candidates running for that election.
So let's talk about the E word. I feel like we always talk to you about this over the years. Ethics.
Ethics.
How come they're not talking about ethics this legislative session?
Well, ethics is about them. And them is very difficult to get them to want to talk about or to want to legislate. So ethics is the one thing that there were two things that didn't get done in the 40 years that I was doing this.
Just two.
Well, two important things. One was ethics reform and the other was campaign finance reform. Now, I think campaign finance reform in the last year or two has gotten a little better. And actually, we now voting has gotten better in the last year or two. They actually have gotten some of this done. And that's because you now have two houses controlled by the same party, so they can do what they think is in their best interest, and it makes it a little easier. But ethics, it doesn't matter. Ethics, nobody wants. If you're in office, you really don't want to address that issue because it mainly impacts you. So they just haven't done it at all. I think that's going to take, I mean, you say, oh, there's corruption. Well, we've had a lot of corruption in New York, just in New York State. I mean, let alone what else goes on around the country or in the national news. But here in New York, that didn't even seem to make a difference. We tried having the governor put it in the budget. And either it fell out of the budget or it just never got brought up during a session. So we'll keep my fingers crossed and put a lot of faith in our current lobbyist, Jennifer Wilson. And perhaps one of these days it will happen. But it didn't happen in the time I was there, no. And we tried.
You're retired now, so you can answer this question. Should the legislature be a full-time job? Should lawmakers not have outside income?
Well, that was a league position. It's hard because the legislature was only making $79.5. Very difficult to live in certain aspects of this state on $79.5.
Right, and they didn't get the raise for 20 years or
and
so.
It was not from 1998 until 2019 before they got their raise. Now they have a raise that's, if you live in upstate, in a small community upstate, $136,000 sounds like a huge amount of money for a salary. However, if you're in downstate, it's about median if you live in Westchester or in the city, one of the boroughs of the city. That said, now that you are making a decent salary, we don't think that you should be hoarding money from outside interests. And I believe that's one of the reasons that some people retired.
Yeah.
Because they did not want to give up that outside income. And you know what? That's a choice that people that run for office should make. I can remember, and he's Tarki Lombardi, who was Senate finance for a number of years in my early years and now has retired also. But he said to me once, he said, I had four or five children. And he said, I knew I wasn't going to be able to educate them on a legislator's salary. So he said, I got out. I retired. I went into business. He later years became a lobbyist, but I believe he was a lawyer, and he went into practice, and he made enough money to send his children to college. Now, that nobody says you're entitled to that seat. You make those decisions, and if you can't give up your outside income, then maybe you should be doing that and not trying to be a legislator too. Because in politics, perception really matters. And nobody, no legislator, should be seen as having two masters, whoever it is they're working for in their private life and the people that they represent. It often just, you know, it kind of doesn't pass the smell test a lot. So I think now the downside of that could very well be that you're not going to get quote-unquote good people because they don't want to, you know, let's just use someone who's now dropped out of a race, so I could use that name, Mr. Bloomberg. I mean, he has lots and lots and lots and lots of money. And so he said, well, you know, I was a good manager. I managed New York City quite well, and I never let my business interest get involved with my political interest. And maybe he was so ethical, it never did. But most people look at that and go, okay, you know, he's got Bloomberg News and he's got this over here. And so who's he going to be more beholden to? We actually have seen that with the person in the White House. And there is always that shadow hanging over, who's he thinking about, his own businesses or the country? So I think when you become a public servant, it really is a public servant. And it really means, and then you wouldn't really have to think too much about term limits, because the original intent of our founders, and George Washington did it, John Adams did it, you know, our early founders, you went in, you gave your life in public servant for 4 years, 8 years, and then you went back to your farm and you went back into private life. And I think in some states, for instance, New Hampshire, there's an old joke about if on your tombstone it doesn't read spent X number of probably a year or two in the state legislature, then you just never made it. So that was kind of the deal. You went into public service for an amount of time to give your expertise and to represent your constituency, and then you left. We have someone recent that did that, Chris Gibson. He was a congressman, and he served for, what, four years, somewhere around there. And then he said, I'm sorry, you know, I've done my public service. I'm going outside. And he's now head of Siena College. And that's kind of the epitome. He did public service in the Army, and then he went into public service in Congress, and then he said, okay, I'm done. And he went back on the outside. That's the way it ran from, and you know, he was a Republican, I think, as I remember.
Correct.
But that's actually the model for how public service was supposed to be. People didn't, in our founders' minds, it didn't mean that you got elected at 22 and you stayed elected until 85. I mean, it just didn't happen. It does happen now in Congress. There are people in Congress who served 50 years. And yes, they keep getting reelected. But I don't think that's happened in the state legislature for quite that long, although
I mean, Bill Larkin just retired. He was there forever.
Yes, he was there forever. And so it's a conflict that goes on in politics all the time, is what's the meaning of public service? And how long should you be a public servant before you actually become just in it for, well, I'm a senator or I'm a congressman or whatever, the name recognition and, you know, someone opens the car door for you. You should really want to serve your constituents. And if $136,000 is all you care to make and you think your constituents think you're doing a great job, then I guess you get reelected. But I don't think it should be the norm. And I think it's too close to being the norm. And yet, I say that, and as a lobbyist, I can tell you that people who've been there a while, take a Dick Gottfried, who's headed the Health Committee, people develop a real expertise, and he does a really good job on the Health Committee. And so you balance that. You know, he's got a lot of knowledge, and so he does a very good job when the state budget is being fashioned. So do you want someone with a lot of expertise? So isn't so beholden to lobbyists who, like me, give legislators information and hope that we can give them enough information to sway them to our point of view? Or do you want someone who has expertise on his own because he's been there a long time and therefore can be what his constituents obviously feel is doing the right thing for them? So it's kind of a, you have to balance that.
Okay, last thing for you.
Okay.
New York has never had a female governor. We've never had a female president. Mm-hmm. Do you see that changing?
Oh, my. I certainly hope it changes in New York State. I think two thoughts. Will it happen at the presidential level before it happens at the state level? I mean, I've given that some thought. We don't have real good benchmarks for people who might want to run for office as governor. Usually, it's people who've been have the prestige of either being a state senator or being a mayor of a large area or maybe being a vice, a lieutenant governor. Now, that could happen with Kathy Hochul. However, we've had, I think, three or four female lieutenant governors. We've never had a female governor. So that hasn't been a jumping off place for our for the history of our lieutenant governors.
And as we know, Andrew Cuomo is raising money
for another,
presumably a fourth term.
Yes. And, you know, that and there again, you know, I remember the days I came in under Hugh Carey. So I remember Mario Cuomo well. And by the time Mario Cuomo ran for his fourth term, it was ABC.
Yeah.
Anybody but Cuomo.
And that's how we ended up with a mayor of
Peekskill. And that's how we ended up with Mr. Pataki. Well, you know, there were some good things with Mr. Pataki. There were some not so good things. I can remember the Fort Pataki, we used to call it. He shut down the second floor, and then we had reporters climbing up on chairs and the glass. Oh, it was a real disaster. And then, but we've been through the coup. I've been through the coups and the Mr. Spitzer's downfall and, you know, all in all, and it was a great ride. I mean, I enjoyed every single minute of it. So there's nothing more exhilarating than actually trying to make government a better thing, a better entity. And I think the League has always been involved on the issues of the day, trying to make things better. And the one thing I keep touting, because it was a big thing back in 1995 because of Joe Bruno's neighbor who had lung cancer, we ended up getting the Clean Indoor Air Act passed. And it's like seatbelts, kind of. It has changed the whole behavior, not only of New York, but of the nation. And now nobody would go into a restaurant or a bar and think about smoking, vaping aside. But tobacco smoking has just the entire, and it has been to the benefit of our young people. I mean, and I have a college student who I have done the same thing with vaping is don't you dare. I mean, it's just, you know, you'll ruin your health, you die, et cetera, et cetera. But that was maybe the biggest accomplishment and it was a consortium of people. It wasn't just the League. There were a group of us. But we changed the behavior and got rid of a product that kills. So that was very, very satisfying. But then good government was always something I dearly loved. And we have made government better inch by inch. Takes a long time. And unfortunately, ethics hasn't gotten done yet.
From our perspective here at the radio, because I think it's a big part of what we do, it's always important to have people watching this store. So, Barbara Bartoletti, thank you. Thanks for your decades of work, and thanks for telling us about it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
All right, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks for listening, and remember to stay subscribed for the latest from the Northeast. Till next time, I'm Ian Pickus.